From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Om Puri. He's made over 130 films in the Indian film industry known as Bollywood. He's known in the West for his British films, My Son the Fanatic and East is East. Now he co-stars in the new Merchant Ivory film, The Mystic Masseur, based on the first novel by the Nobel Prize winner V.S. Naipaul. The pajama game is currently being revived in New York by the City Center Encore series, Great American Musicals in Concert. The show introduced the songs Steam Heat, Hernando's Hideaway, and Hey There. We'll listen to an interview with Richard Adler, who co-wrote the songs with Jerry Ross. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Spider-Man. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI suspects domestic terrorists are behind a series of pipe bombings in rural Illinois and Iowa that have injured at least seven people. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The explosives were planted in rural mailboxes and apparently rigged to go off when they were removed. Some of the injured are letter carriers. None of the injuries is said to be life-threatening. About a half dozen bombs exploded within a 150-mile radius of Davenport, Iowa. In a news conference carried on CNN, Postal Inspector Linda Jensen said nearly all of the bombs were accompanied by a clear plastic bag containing a typewritten letter full of anti-government propaganda.
If such material is discovered by a postal customer or a carrier at this point, please, please do not touch the item or slam the box door.
The FBI says it doesn't know if all the bombs have been found yet and probably won't know for a while. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Archdiocese of Boston says it's backing out of a settlement agreement with more than 80 people who accused a former priest of sexually abusing children. The Finance Council of the Archdiocese refused to fund the agreement, saying it would consume most of the Archdiocese's resources and leave it without enough money to provide a response to other victims. The original deal was estimated to be worth between $15 and $30 million. The Archdiocese is already believed to have paid about $15 million to 40 people who say they were molested by former priest John Gagan. President Bush chided Senate Democrats today for what he called a vacancy crisis in federal courts. The president complained that too few of his nominees to the federal bench have been confirmed by the Democratic-run Senate. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
With one out of every 10 seats vacant on the federal bench, the president declared justice is at risk in America. He added he's nominated what he called 100 outstanding jurists to fill those vacancies.
But the Senate has not acted. And by its inaction, the Senate is endangering the administration of justice in America.
But Democrat Patrick Leahy disagrees. He says the Senate Judiciary Committee he chairs has in 10 months confirmed more than half the president's court nominees.
We're really cutting heavily into the backlog that was created because the Republicans refused to confirm President Clinton's nominees, and we intend to do that.
Leahy promised even controversial Bush nominees will get a hearing but will not get rubber stamp approval. David Wallner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 85 points to close at 10,006 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 31 points, or nearly 2%. It closed at 1,613. This is NPR News. A federal appeals court in Washington has unanimously upheld tougher pollution regulations for big trucks and diesel fuel. The regulations, which are supported by the Environmental Protection Agency, say that trucks must cut their tailpipe pollution emissions by 2007. Truck engine manufacturers say the technology isn't available to meet that deadline. The regulations also require fuel manufacturers to cut the amount of sulfur in diesel fuel. Refiners say the cuts aren't achievable and could lead to supply shortages. Secretary of State Colin Powell says he and his Russian counterpart made progress on an arms control agreement in hopes that it will be ready in time for a summit later this month. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Powell told reporters he was encouraged by his talks with Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov.
I'm encouraged by the progress we've made, and the remaining differences are there, and we needed to spend more time working on them and discussing them to see if we can resolve them in time for the Moscow summit.
President Bush is to visit Moscow and St. Petersburg later this month for a summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The two have already agreed in principle to drastically cut their nuclear arsenals, but the Russians want to make sure that dismantled warheads are destroyed, not stored. And negotiators are still trying to work out a formal agreement. Powell says the work will continue even if they can't finish it by the time of the summit. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Two concourses at the Cleveland International Airport were shut down for more than 2 hours today after a screening machine detected possible explosives in a carry-on bag. Security guards didn't respond to the alarm until after the passenger had already taken the bag and left. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at www.fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Om Puri, has made over 130 movies, mostly in Bombay, in the Indian film industry known as Bollywood. He's acted in commercial films and art films. He's also starred in the British films My Son the Fanatic, in which he played an Indian emigre whose son has become a Muslim fundamentalist, and East is East, in which he played a Pakistani emigre trying to raise his children with Pakistani traditions. Now Om Puri co-stars in the new Merchant Ivory movie The Mystic Masseur, adapted from a novel set in Trinidad by Nobel Prize winner V.S. Naipaul. It's about a schoolteacher living in the island's capital city. When he learns his father has died, he returns to the village where he grew up and decides that in order to fulfill his dream of becoming a writer, he should remain in the village and write. Om Puri plays the neighbor who encourages the writer and also wants to set him up with his daughter.
Sahib, something happened to Leela Foot. I wonder if you can take a look at it.
I'm not no doctor, man. I don't know how to take care of nobody's foot.
Man, how can you say that? Your father was the best massager we ever had. It's in your blood, Sahib. Leela, come here.
Where it hurt? It hurt here?
Yes, Sahib.
Or more over here?
You get the feel, Sahib. You get the gift.
Pa, it fix. It don't hurt no more.
It fix?
I can't tell you, Sahib. You is your father's son. I wonder why you don't take up massaging. That way you get to know everybody in the village. You're part of the community, Sahib. Man of the people.
I spoke with actor Om Puri in 2000. You made about 130 films in India. That's a staggering number of films. Tell me what the production schedule is like that would enable you to make so many films.
Well, India is the largest film-producing country in the world. I mean, it's a huge country with 900 million people and about 23 different languages. And the main national language is Hindi. And, I mean, I worked mostly in Hindi films. So for an actor, it is not a big deal to do, 130 films in 24 years. There are actors in India who really overwork too much, and they may be in their mid-60s or something, and they may have done 350 films, you know, which is quite... if you have a major part, if you're playing a central part, then maybe you'll be required for 8 weeks to finish the film. And in some films, you may have a smaller part, which means you may be required for 3 weeks or 4 weeks. So easily, you can do 5-6 films in a year.
What are some of the typical roles you've played in Indian movies?
Well, I have been mostly associated, my early career, for about 10-12 years, I have been with the art cinema, which is... a cinema which is socially relevant, which talks about the social issues, social political issues, etc., which is small in nature, which is small in budget also, and whereas the commercial cinema is huge, big canvas, big money, and art cinema gave me respect credibility, status, and gave me opportunity to travel all over the world, because those films went to all kind of festivals all over the world. Whereas commercial cinema gave me a standard of living back home. So I'm part of my work, which is about 35-40%, is commercial cinema, which essentially is an entertaining cinema and what we call escapist cinema.
From what I've seen of Indian movies, a lot of the commercial movies are musicals with big production numbers, and I'm not sure how much of a plot there even is. Tell us
about... Plots are very, very repetitive in Indian films.
What are some of the typical stories in the plots?
Well, typical stories, you see, it's like a sheep mentality. You know, suppose there is an action film which becomes a big hit, then everybody will be making action films for a couple of years till they exhaust that genre. And then suddenly someone will make a love story, meets girl kind of a thing, and becomes a big hit. Then everybody starts making love stories till they exhaust themselves. And they are greatly influenced by the American cinema. Any film which is a big hit here, they will try and adopt it and make a Indian film out of it.
Did you do a lot of musicals?
Well, I have been in musicals, but essentially I have been a character actor in those films. I did initially a couple of films with songs and dances, but actually I feel very uncomfortable in those kind of parts. But I have played major characters in big budget films.
So why do you feel uncomfortable in the singing parts? Because there seems to be so many of them.
Because I find it ridiculous. I find it illogical. In fact, the other day, someone here asked me, you know, how come, you know, in your film, suddenly we see your characters in films singing and dancing in Vancouver or in Switzerland or in South Africa. How does that happen in the plot? I said, well, the Indian characters dream. They dream that we are in Switzerland, so they are in Switzerland. You know? Or they dream they are in Vancouver, so you immediately cut, oh, we are in Vancouver.
No, I think one of the directors you worked with in your years working in the art cinema was Satyajit Ray.
That's right.
What was the name of the film that you did with Satyajit Ray?
It was, in Hindi, it was called Sadgati, S-A-D-G-A-T-I, which means deliverance.
Did he give you any new insights into acting or, you know, into acting on camera?
In my mind was that, you know, one had a view that Mr. Ray, since he does so much paperwork and you will be just put into a straitjacket and, you know, you won't have any flexibility to do what you want to do. You know, I thought it was just a misconception of people. He was very, very flexible. Yes, true, he did a lot of homework. He did have a paperwork done. But he would give a lot of freedom to the actors. And he was open to any new thing which would help better the film. I mean, one day, for example, we were supposed to be doing the climax scene, which is a big scene, and which he had various shots worked out for it. And it was lunch. Immediately after lunch, I noticed that he's looking at the sky and with eyes absolutely focused. And he kept staring at the sky for a good 30 seconds. I said, what's happening? And we saw it's cloudy. And suddenly he just went berserk and he ordered that put the maximum trolley you have, just fix that. So we had about 100 feet trolley, and which was put. And he took that entire scene in one shot. And it was very dramatic because it started raining, and that's what he expected. And he wanted to use the rain. But at the same time, he changed his shots. Instead of taking different shots, he took one shot because obviously he thought that if the rain stops in between and he hasn't finished the scene, then where will he get the artificial rain? So that was very clever and very, very sort of thoughtful of that. And exactly what his fears were, it was right. I mean, the moment we finished that scene, we took about 3 takes and the rain stopped. And then, you know, certain close-ups of mine were done with, because since it was just a close-up, with a bucket and somebody held a branch of a tree over my head and threw a little water on top. And that's how the close-ups were done.
Your father was an officer in the British Army during the era when India was ruled by England. What attitude were you brought up with regarding British rule?
Well, I was born in 50, and we got independence in 47. So the British had left. I waited for them to go, to come into the world. my father did, he was greatly influenced by the Britishers. I mean, he used to refer to their discipline constantly. In fact, he used to, you know, sometime make a comment on that, you know, I wish the Britishers had not gone because we don't know how to look after ourselves, etc. So he had a hangover of British Empire in him. I mean, particularly he used to refer to, you know, because we Indians tend to not, you know, have a great deal of respect for time. You know, if somebody says, oh, well, you're supposed to be there at 9, I mean, it could be 9:40, it could be 9:50. So that used to bug him and irritate him. And plus, you know, the English, for example, is a language of, like any other language in India. I mean, like we have 23 regional languages, and English is also one of them. So it is not that for Indians, English is not a foreign language. It is part of the Indian ethos now. I mean, any child who goes to school automatically learns English. All the government work, central government work, is done in English. All the business in India is done in English.
What was it like to have a part in the movie Gandhi about driving out the British after your father had worked in the British Army?
Well, Gandhi, I had a small cameo, but it was an important moment in the film when Gandhi is sitting on a fast in Calcutta and he wants to, you know, stop the riots between Hindus and Muslims. And I was representing the angry Hindus and, you know, a group of Hindus laying arms in front of him and pledging that we will stop the riots, to which I sort of barge in and throw a piece of bread on his face and say, okay, don't die, old man, but here, listen, I have a story. My child was killed by Muslims who was 5-year-old, and now you want us to stop killing Muslims? And then Gandhi gives his own view that, okay, now you pick up a Muslim child and bring him up as your own. And that breaks him, and, you know, he breaks down and he falls at his feet and he gives in. So it's a nice moment in the film Gandhi, which I enjoyed. It was only, as I said, it was a small part. I was not with the unit for a long time. But nicely, I was, you know, pleasantly surprised when that year the Oscars were going on, and a couple of my friends in India called me up. He said, hey, put on your television. They are showing your scene in the Oscars. So I was quite tickled. And but by the time I switched on, it had gone because it was such a small clipping.
My guest is Indian actor Om Puri. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview recorded in 2000 with actor Om Puri, who has made over 130 movies in India. He also starred in the British films East is East and My Son the Fanatic, and he co-stars in the new Merchant Ivory movie, The Mystic Masseur. Are actors in India, successful actors, treated as stars in the way that we have stars in America? You know, like this, the celebrity class is a class unto itself in America. They have a lot of money. They live in separate places. They tend to socialize with each other and to be treated almost like, you know, gods and goddesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is same there. But to be honest, I don't fall into that category and neither I would want to. I am very well known all over India. But the only difference is they wouldn't want to tear my clothes if they see me. Yes, they would want to talk to me. They would want to have a chat with me. They would want to know what I'm doing here. They'll be very interested. Perhaps, you know, the kind of image which I have created for myself through my films, because the films are, they are not fantasies, you know. They've been real films. So my image as a social being is very different than the commercial stars. And I don't avoid people, you know, whether it's at the airport, whether it's in a social place or in a market, suppose you bump into, you know, people. And if we are filming outdoors, we do attract a lot of crowd. And if people want to have a word, you know, one goes up to them and says hello. But I do attract a lot of crowds and I do get fan mail and all those things are there. But as you earlier asked me, do we have stars who live separately, who have flashy cars, you know? Well, we do. We do.
Well, what are some of your impressions of the differences for an actor making a Western movie compared to an Indian film?
The major difference in India, particularly in commercial cinema, is the fact that the films are not shot at a stretch. They are shot in bits and pieces. You shoot for a film for 10 days and then you don't shoot for that film for 3 months. Then you shoot for 20 days. Then you don't shoot for that for maybe 6 months. So it's shot in bits and pieces, which is a very erratic way of working, really.
That sounds really odd.
Sorry?
I said that sounds really odd because, first of all, your body can change in 6 months. And second of all...
Yes, and it does. Uh-huh. It does, you know. But people try and, you know, say, for example, they will keep the same haircut for every role they play, you know, the commercial actors. And they would try and keep the same weight. But a lot of times, if the film gets delayed, which it does actually, you know, normal Hindi commercial film takes 1.5 years to, it can go up to 3 years. So in 3 years, people do change. People put on weight, people, you know. So that's a major difference, really. And whereas in the West, I presume, you know, particularly the films which I have done, 10, 12 films abroad, that the films are shot at a stretch. And another peculiar thing, which is quite funny, is that commercial cinema does not give you a copy of a script, unlike the art cinema in India. They tell you a story and they tell you your character, but you don't have a copy of script in your hand.
So how do you learn your lines?
You get it on the same day when you go for filming. You get it on the same morning. So no homework is expected from an actor.
What's the rationale behind that?
Well, rationale is that they are not ready with their scripts. In fact, when they ask me in India, you know, what is the difference between shooting in the West and East and here, I say, well, they work on a script for 2 years. And then go ahead and shoot the film within 6 months and that's it. And you work here for 2 months on a script and then go on shooting for 3 years. But Terry, let me tell you, the thing is, they feel very insecure, the producers. That is why they don't give you a copy of the script. Because they all get worried that somebody else will steal their subject. Because we don't have a serious copyright, etc. So therefore, they don't reveal their scripts. They would have a copy of the script, but it will be with them. And they never reveal the climax of the film till the end. When they're almost done with the entire film, then they go and shoot the climax because they feel that some other producer or director will steal their idea and they won't have the novelty.
So how do you evaluate if you want to do a movie or not if you haven't even had a chance to read the script?
Well, you know the story and you know the character and you take it from there. I mean, when the scene comes in front of you and the senior actors would sit on it, maybe disagree and, you know, change, talk about it, and then take their time to prepare the part. But it is not a professional way of working, and that is why that cinema does not really interest me so much, though I have to work in it because, you know, for the living, because that cinema has given me all the goodies in life. All the facilities I enjoy did come from commercial cinema, so I am grateful to that cinema also. I try to be as disciplined as professional as I am for art films. I treat commercial cinema also the same way, like going on the set on time. But our stars are quite notorious. I mean, they don't show up on time. This is, something which is very, very annoying. They are pretty indulgent. Unlike the West, even huge stars, I have whatever films I have, whether it was Patrick Swayze or Val Kilmer or, Michael Douglas, all of them, I mean, they are absolutely punctual, they are ready with their lines, and they are, truly professional. And I hope this sense of professionalism comes into the Indian commercial atmosphere also.
Now, you had said that you didn't have an agent until after City of Joy. City of Joy, yeah. So how did you get by in Indian cinema making all those movies without an agent? Do people just call you personally? You know, in America, like, everybody has an agent if they're making movies.
No, in India, I do have what we call, we don't call it agent, we call it a secretary. So I do have a secretary in India, but he doesn't look for work for me. The work comes and he handles it, mm-hmm. In terms of organizing dates or talking to the producers about money and then, recovering the money, looking after my income tax, etc. All this job is done by him. But he, in fact, when I did take on a secretary, I told him also, I said, please, you don't look for work. The work will come. And we are supposed to handle it. Because suppose you bring in work, and which I don't like, you make an effort, and then it will be, it won't be nice that I say no to it. And, I'll also feel embarrassed by saying no, because I want to make choices.
Actor Om Puri co-stars in the new Merchant Ivory film, The Mystic Masseur. Our interview was recorded in 2000. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Delacourt Press, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light by Nicole Mones, a novel set in modern China by the author of Lost in Translation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's called Hernando's Hideaway. Ole. All you see are silhouettes.
The classic musical The Pajama Game is being revived in New York. Coming up, an interview with Richard Adler, who co-wrote the songs for The Pajama Game and Damn Yankees. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Spider-Man, and we continue our conversation with actor Om Puri.
At the Golden Finger Bowl or any place you go. Your Uncle Max and everyone you know. But if we go to the spot that I am thinking of, you will be free to gaze at me and talk of love. Just knock three times and whisper low that you and I was sent by Joe. Then strike a match and you will know you're in Hernando's Hideaway. Olé.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Indian actor Om Puri. He's made over 130 movies, mostly in the Indian film industry known as Bollywood. He's also starred in the British films East is East and My Son the Fanatic. He co-stars in the new Merchant Ivory movie, The Mystic Masseur, based on a novel by Nobel Prize winner V.S. Naipaul. I spoke with Om Puri in 2000. Om Puri, how did you end up acting? How old were you when you decided you wanted to act?
Well, in school, I was fascinated by army. I wanted to be a soldier. But when I reached college, I drifted. I mean, I started participating in college activities. And one of them was also working in the plays. And I was picked up by a couple from a youth festival, college youth festival, where they were one of the judges. And they had their own semi-professional theater group. And they invited me to join that. And I joined their theater group. And, while I was doing my college, I did a number of plays with them. They did a lot of Western plays also, like Strindberg and Bernard Shaw, Ibsen. And also Indian social plays. And then that's where I really got hooked on to. And through them, I came to know about National School of Drama, which I joined later. So that's how I really drifted. And I mean, I was very shy and very reserved as a child. Very, very introvert. And I think somewhere I feel that by acting in those social plays, somewhere I found a great satisfaction that something which I feel strongly about your society, about your views on the society, what you see on the streets, etc. And those plays were giving voice to my emotions.
Did acting make you less shy?
Eventually it did, over a period of time. I could be exuberant in, strangely, in a scene. But the moment scene is over and I'm back to normal life, I would again go into my shell. It went on. In fact, I remember in drama school, I was supposed to do a very tender romantic scene. I think we were doing, yes, it was Kukeshan Chalk Circle, and I was playing Simon. And I was supposed to hold hand of this girl, and I was about 20 that time. And I was very sort of, I was shivering. And then the director noticed, and he took me aside. He said, "Om, explain me, feel comfortable. You must, it's emotions, and these are noble emotions, etc., etc." So gradually, I think I did, become comfortable.
Now, you've been making more movies in England. I imagine one of the obstacles you're up against is trying to find good roles for an Indian actor.
Yes.
My guess would be there aren't a lot of them.
Yes, I wouldn't say there are a lot of them. And that's why I'm not leaving my ground.
Right.
That's Bombay.
Right.
So whenever I have an opportunity, because I've been enjoying to work in the West, and I hope I do find, roles like in the past, people who had faces like me, like Mr. Anthony Quinn, who has been my favorite, and also Omar Sharif, who could look like an Arab. And I hope that I do have interesting parts, not necessarily major roles, but interesting characters. I'll be happy enough to work in those.
You said that people like Anthony Quinn and Omar Sharif have faces like you. What kind of face do you have?
I think, I essentially have an Asian face and a gypsy face. And I could be from Arab. I could be from South America, parts of South America. So it's not necessarily a Indian face. It's a rustic face. It's not traditional good-looking chocolate face.
What does chocolate face mean?
Chocolate face means well-chiseled, beautiful, you know, everything proportional. I have a big nose, big fat nose. And I have pockmarks, which I got it when I was about 5, I think. I had smallpox. And
you had smallpox?
Yes, I had smallpox when I was about 5.
And that scarred your face?
Yes.
Wow, do you have a lot of memories of when you had smallpox?
I think I have been even smaller than that. The only image I do remember that my mother used to tie me to the cot, when she had to do some work. She used to tie me so that I don't scratch. She used to tie my hands to the cot.
Did you?
That image I do remember.
Was it questionable whether you'd survive or not?
Yes, it could have been, because we were actually a big family. We were 8 brothers, sisters, and today we are just 2 of us. I'm the youngest in the family, and my mother lost all 6 of them. My eldest brother, she lost him when he was 15, one brother at the age of 9, one sister at the age of 5. One sister I remember seeing when I was in college, she was married, and she also died in her, I think she was about 40.
What did they die of?
Well, various diseases. You see, that time, we are talking about, say, 45 years ago. And that time in small towns, etc., the health conditions were pretty bad. My mother said, you know, your eldest brother just came back from school and she saw his face was red. And she thought it just, you know, little, his body was warm. She thought just a little temperature or something. But he may have had a high fever. And he just collapsed next day. It was, now, of course, the survival rate, of course, is much, much higher. But in those days, the survival rate was pretty low. And that was one of the reasons why people had a lot of children in the past, because they didn't know how many of them will survive.
When you were growing up with the pockmarks left from smallpox, were you very self-conscious about that as a kid?
I was, to be honest. You know, when I used to look at films, etc., and that is why, perhaps one of the reasons why I didn't go directly to cinema. I went into theater, and I thought, I don't have a right kind of a face for the theater. Till I was exposed to world cinema, you know, when I saw, the international cinema or cinema of Satyajit Ray and Mrinal Sen, then I saw that, you know, oh, well, there are faces like me in these films. And since I was only exposed to the commercial Indian cinema, you know, which had most faces were chiseled, what we call chocolate faces.
Mm-hmm. Were you worried about the close-ups,
then,
too?
Yes. Then my taboo really sort of broke, and I started thinking in terms of... I was no longer self-conscious, and today I'm not. In fact, when I came to Bombay, some of my senior friends did suggest me that I should go in for plastic surgery. I said, no, I will not fool around with my body, but I will play, I will accept whatever his nature has given me.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
I just think it's really good when people can have their real faces and don't have to get them surgically altered, because there's so much of that now. And it's also one of the things that makes you so interesting to watch, because you have such a real face, an expressive one at that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine myself going through plastic surgery looking at myself that, you know, where is the person gone with whom I had lived for 30 years or 35 years? Yeah?
Well, Om Puri, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been great talking to you, and it's a great pleasure.
Om Puri recorded 2 years ago. He's starring in the new Merchant Ivory film, The Mystic Masseur. Coming up, Richard Adler, who co-wrote the songs for The Pajama Game, which is currently being revived in New York. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The musical The Pajama Game is being revived in New York this weekend by the City Center Encore series Great American Musicals in Concert. The show is a romantic comedy set in a pajama factory that's in the middle of a labor dispute. The Pajama Game introduced such songs as Hernando's Hideaway, Hey There, and Steam Heat, and won the 1955 Tony Award for Best Musical. The songs were co-written by Richard Adler and Jerry Ross. After The Pajama Game, Adler and Ross collaborated on the hit Damn Yankees, which included their songs You Gotta Have Heart and Whatever Lola Wants. But the Adler-Ross collaboration ended abruptly after that, when Jerry Ross died at the age of 29. I spoke with Richard Adler in 1990, after the publication of his memoir, You Gotta Have Heart. This year, he was awarded the ASCAP Foundation's Richard Rodgers Award. Let's start with one of the hit songs from The Pajama Game.
Yeah! I got steam heat, I got steam heat, I got steam heat, but I need your love to keep away the cold, I got.
Back in the days that you wrote Pajama Game and Damn Yankees, 54, 55, was everything offered to Rodgers and Hammerstein first?
Everything was offered to everybody first before us. We were totally unknown, inexperienced, and when we were handed the Pajama Game by George Abbott, which was called 7½ Cents, the book, and we read the book, I really liked the book very much, and we got a break on that.
When you wrote a song for The Pajama Game, who would you have to play the song for before it got okayed?
George Abbott. Period.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of critiques would he give you?
Critiques? None. He would say yes or no. For the dictaphone song, he wanted a song in a that could be dictated into a dictaphone machine. They didn't have tapes in those days. They had dictaphone machines. So we wrote a terrible song called Dear Babe. And he thought it was terrible. We thought it was terrible, too. He said, give me something a little bit more unique. And then we wrote Hey There. And he liked that a lot and went into the show. Then when it was in the show, being a young, idiotic, and compulsive man, I suddenly thought, gee, this song, it's very lovely, but it maybe isn't commercial enough. And I wrote 6 songs trying to write around Hey There to get it out of the show. And Abbott kept saying, don't bother me, I like Hey There, each time. He would listen, and he, thank God, didn't succumb to my persuasiveness.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. To be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her. Her nose in the air. She has you dancing on a string. Break it, and she won't care. Will you take this advice I hand you like a brother? Or are you not seeing things too clear? Are you just too far gone to hear? Is it all going in one ear and out the other?
You work collaboratively with Jerry Ross, and you both wrote words and music, right?
Right.
What were the mechanics of the relationship?
Well, there were no mechanics to the relationship. We wrote every which way imaginable. Sometimes I would come in with a lyric or a melody, and he would elaborate on it. Sometimes he would, like for instance with Steam Heat. I went to the bathroom one day, And when I got in there, I decided, as I said before, I was a compulsive young man. I decided I'm not leaving this room until I've written a song about something in the room. So there were certain things you can't write about in a bathroom. Then all of a sudden the radiator started clanging and hissing, and I got the idea for Steam Heat. I wrote out a full chorus of it, got out of the bathroom, called Jerry, sang it to him over the phone. We got together the next day and elaborated on it. That's one way that we wrote.
After the success of Pajama Game, you very quickly got involved in writing the words and music for Damn Yankees. Was it easier to write a Broadway show the second time around?
No, much harder.
Why was it harder?
First of all, we had written with much greater abandon when we wrote Pajama Game because we didn't know what to be afraid of, like the critics. Though the critics were all marvelous to us in Pajama Game, we began to fear that they might not be in Damn Yankees, so we got a little bit apprehensive about that.
One of the best-known songs from Damn Yankees is You've Gotta Have Heart.
You've Gotta Have Heart is the best-known song I think probably I've ever written, and it became a tremendous hit in the show. It stopped the show from the first performance on.
Now listen to me, you guys. This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else, something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope.
Your songwriting partner, Jerry Ross, died after Damn Yankees at the age of 29. You were devastated by that.
I certainly was. I was devastated, and that was 35 years ago, and I'm still devastated by it. He was like my brother. He was my beloved friend, my younger brother, my collaborator. He was everything to me at the time. And it took many years of struggle before I was able to succeed once again. I really literally had to start all over.
Richard Adler recorded in 1990. He co-wrote the songs for The Pajama Game and Damn Yankees. The Pajama Game is being revived in New York this weekend by the City Center Encore series, Great American Musicals in Concert. We're going to hear Richard Adler singing with a songwriting partner, Jerry Ross, at the piano, as recorded in 1954 on the CBS radio show Stage Struck, hosted by Mike Wallace. It's a bonus track on the recent reissue of the original cast recording of The Pajama Game.
Today, the theater looks to the young composers who may become the humans of their day. Composers like Dick Adler and Jerry Ross. Right now, they're over in Boston helping to shape up a show in which they've done all the music and lyrics. It's the musical adaptation of the riotous novel about the pajama industry, 7½ Cents, which is called now in its stage form, Pajama Game.
I'm told that you boys play and sing everything you write, so how about it?
Sure, Mike. We'll be glad to give you a sample of one of our songs just to show you how composers can butcher their own material.
I know a dark, secluded place. A place where no one knows your face. A glass of wine, a fast embrace. It's called Hernando's Hideaway. Only you see a silhouette, and all you hear are castanets, and no one cares how late it gets. Not at Hernando's Hideaway, only. At the Golden Finger Bowl or any place you go. Meet your Uncle Max and everyone you know. But if we go to the spot that I am thinking of, you will be free to gaze at me and talk of love.
just knock three times and whisper love that to you and I was sent by Joe. Then strike a match and you will know you're in Hernando's hideaway. Holy.
Songwriters Richard Adler and Jerry Ross recorded in 1954. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews Spider-Man. This is Fresh Air. Spider-Man made his comic book debut 40 years ago. The new movie Spider-Man is co-produced by the superhero's co-creator, Stan Lee. It stars Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst and is directed by Sam Raimi. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Let's face it, they'll probably never get the real Marvel deal. The funky, cheap paper, weird outfit, off-kilter Marvel on screen. Spider-Man the movie has less to do with the mind-altering experience of opening a strange Marvel than with watching a teenage romance spliced together with footage from an animated film. Still, the first hour is lively, engaging fun. Certainly Tobey Maguire's impersonation of Peter Parker, the epitome of the 120-pound high school weakling, is on the money. His moody reserve clicks with co-star Kirsten Dunst, who matches up her usual perk with some subterranean unhappiness of her own. As Mary Jane Watson, girlfriend to her high school's chief jock, she can't make any overt moves towards Weenie Parker, but he does pop up on her radar. Peter, of course, longs for next-door neighbor Mary Jane with all his heart, hoping to rescue her from her abusive father and watching her from the home he shares with his Uncle Ben and Aunt May. Anyone under 55 knows what happens next. Parker gets bitten by a biologically enhanced spider and ends up transformed into a muscular acrobatic web spinner. Eventually, he becomes Spider-Man's superhero. Meanwhile, a parallel transformation occurs to Norman Osborn, a wealthy arms manufacturer. Played by the already creepy-looking Willem Dafoe, he tries out a genetically transforming drug on himself in order to crush a competitor, an unexpectedly welcome bit of political satire. Uh-oh, he turns into the arch-villain, the Green Goblin. All this takes up an hour of running time. Usually when a filmmaker spends an hour on his setup, you chalk it up to bad storytelling. But in this case, you're tempted to say that director Sam Raimi found this part of the movie the most interesting. I certainly did. As an Irish Catholic kid growing up in suburban Boston, reading a Marvel comic conveyed a shiver of sinfulness. I couldn't then and can't now put my finger on just why. Spider-Man especially featured what I would later recognize as a carnival of Freudian types. There are living and dead father figures, passive-aggressive mother figures, unattainable objects of desire, superegos, egos, doppelgangers and ids. But if your ego can control your id can be your friend. Listen here as Mary Jane expresses her love for Peter's costumed, controlled id, and Peter expresses his appreciation.
The fact is, I'm in love with somebody else.
You are?
At least I think I am. It's not the right time to talk about it.
No, go on. Would I know his name, this guy?
You'll think I'm a stupid little girl with a crush.
Trust me.
It's funny. He saved my life twice, and I've never even seen his face.
Oh, him.
You're laughing at me.
No, I understand. He is extremely cool.
But do you think it's true, all the terrible things they say about him?
No, no. Not Spider-Man, not a chance in the world. I know him a little bit.
Talk dirty to me, baby. All this is fun and lends another level to the movie for those who want to see more than Peter beating up the high school bully. But it doesn't really add as much to the movie as you might think. It doesn't deepen the characters, it just fits them into a psychological matrix. In a comic book, that's okay, because its impact of color and design has an explosive effect on the imagination that's close to catalytic. But a movie works on a whole different level, and during Spider-Man's second hour, you can see how needy it is. The characters have no punch because they're not really characters, just elemental psychological figures. Yet it's just at this moment that the movie asks us to care the most about them as people, to think of them almost as tragic. It doesn't take. The cartoonishness extends to the computer effects. Because they know no limits, computers can do anything, even the impossible. But we know the impossible when we see it, and we see it too often in Spider-Man. The whole Hollywood fascination with comic book heroes is bizarre. A legion of middle-aged men are behind these projects, and their ostensible excuse that the public eats these projects up only partially explains their compulsive production. At $9 a pop, we might be paying for studio executives' therapy.
Film critic Henry Sheehan is based in Los Angeles. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Empire Falls by Richard Russo. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, surfing the asphalt waves, we talk with Stacy Peralta, one of the fathers of extreme skateboarding. He's made a new skateboard documentary called Dogtown and Z-Boys. Also, film director Alfonso Cuarón talks about his new movie, Y Tu Mamá También. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.